Thank you so much for organizing. Thanks so much for hosting. For the last year or so, we've been working our way through some of the practical issues in Hilchos Shabbos. Last year, before Pesach, everybody started tilting into Kashrus with a Shira on Tefillas Kelim. And tonight we get together to continue Hilchos Kashrus with a look at Bishul Akum. The truth is, as I've said in the past, the multiple goals to having this sort of conversation and this sort of shiur, first of which is just to open a conversation and to make it comfortable, to reach out with questions going forward. And I think Baruch Hashem already the shiurim have helped in terms of that, just opening the doors so that a group conversation about kashrus and about Shabbos and about halacha in general can translate into. Can translate into individual follow-up conversations about specific situations. Please do not hesitate to reach out. Don't hesitate to reach out to us. Don't hesitate to reach out to our wives. That's what we're here for. But the purpose of the shiur obviously is not only to open the conversation so that we can continue, but really to appreciate what it is that we do and why we do it. To understand more of the what and to appreciate more of the why. And Bishul Akum in particular, whenever you deal with a halacha that's midrabanan, so the motivation tends to be more upfront. You have a pasuk in Chumash, you have a mitzvah daraisa, so sometimes the Torah is clear about what the rationale is, what the themes are that are being moved forward by the halacha, and sometimes the Torah is not clear. The Torah will just lay out, the psukim will lay out rules, and sometimes the motivation may remain mysterious. But when you have a halacha that's midrabanan, so the Chachamim will explain, here's the legislation, and here's the reason why. And Bishul Akum is one of those areas where not only does the Gemara speak about the rationale, but it speaks to sort of a larger principle. As we'll soon get into the details, but the concept of Bishul Akum already appears in a Mishnah on Masechet Avodah Zarah. The Mishnah speaks about a series of foods that are manufactured under non-Jewish auspices that Jews are supposed to avoid. And one of them is Bishul Akum, food that was cooked by a non-Jew. As we're going to see, we'll get in a moment into details. I'm going to talk about which was yes and which was not and what sort of situations, yes and not. But the concept, the Gemara explains, of a number of these Machali Akum, a number of these non-Jewish produced foods, Bishul Akum presumably among them, is even if the food is kosher, but Chachamim were looking for a larger picture. The Chachamim were looking, the way the Gemara puts it, Mishum Chasas. We're worried ultimately about intermarriage. In other words, where Chachamim were concerned, we interact with all sorts of people, but we need to have a clarity that all human beings are created B'Tzamel Kim, as the Mishnah tells us, based on the Psukim. At the same time, Chaviv in Yisrael, Shenikur. There's a unique ease of connection that Klal Yisrael shares with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we should be proud of that distinction, and we should be proud of the values that we have and of the lifestyle that we're called upon to lead. And Chachamim wanted to put rules into place to make sure that to avoid over-socialization and to put rules into place to remind us to be friendly with everyone and at the same time that our good friends are people with whom we share key values, and to maintain the clarity of that distinction, so the way to a person's heart is often through his or her stomach. And so Chacham said, if there'll be speed bumps along the way in terms of how we eat with other people, if it's not just totally smooth to eat with anyone, so that'll remind us that this is a situation, I'm eating with non-Jews, this is a situation where I need to be careful. This situation where I need to be mindful of maintaining healthy, holy, spiritual, social boundaries. So that's sort of the guiding principle behind Bishul Akum. It's a specific din, and we'll start to get into nitty-gritty very soon. A lot of the details are very nitty-gritty, but the concept is maintaining the pride in the specialness of being a Jew. Maintaining pride in the specialness of being a Banam HaMakom with all the responsibility that comes with that. But to have great pride in that, and to maintain a distinction between friendly and friends, that the Havdalah bein Yisrael la'am, mehein am levadad yishkon, that is the overall value that Bishul Akum moves forward. So let's with that in mind, and if you're following along on the outlines, so as we move from section 2 to 3, from the why to the what, or to the which foods, just to overview as we move into Hilchas Bishul Akum, which if past performance is any indication, I imagine it will take us more than one shiur to work through the principle Bishul Akum, and that is absolutely great. As always, I said before some of you come in, one of the larger goals of this year and of these shiurim is to encourage more conversation about halacha and to make it more comfortable to reach out with questions beyond this year. But obviously, that starts right here. So you should feel comfortable jumping in. I do not necessarily anticipate we're going to cover all the hilchos Bishul Akum in one sitting. But just to overview where we're headed. Well, we think about, as with many areas of halacha, it often divides along the lines of the what and the how, or which items and what is the process, which processes. And Bishul Akum definitely fits that. We're going to be, ultimately, the last section, section 5, is a question of what sorts of cooking is susceptible to Bishul Akum and which not. What sort of intent a Nachri would have in order to create Bishul Akum, and what sort of cooking, non-cooking processes like microwaving and things like that. And, of course, we'll close, probably not tonight, with the question of Jewish participation. How much does, if a Nachri is cooking by him or herself, that could be a Bishul Akum. If a Jew and non-Jew participate together, that's not Bishul Akum. How much participation do I have to do? Do I have to light the fire? Do I have to do something with the food? Light the fire before, after, turn it up, turn it down, take the pot off, put the pot back on. Good ideas, bad ideas, when are our instincts correct, and when might our instincts in the kitchen lead us awry? That's the last section. And that's section 5. Section 4, we'll talk about a couple of the exceptional cases of Bishul Akum, and as we will see, I mean exceptional in more than one sense. But we begin the halachos by jumping first just the question of what? Which foods are susceptible to Bishul Akum and which are not? If I'm looking at an item that's not all foods are Bishul Akum sensitive, so it's not Bishul Akum sensitive, the Nachri can process it however he or she likes, it's not a problem whatsoever. That's really the first thing. We begin with those issues in part because they're the simplest to begin with, and in part because both the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch open the discussion of Bishul Akum with this question. And first, just to get a misconception off the table, if you're following along in the outline, I guess we're up to 3a, and it, just to clarify, as we dive into Bishul Akum, we're assuming, when we talk about Bishul Akum, the assumption is that the food is all kosher before you get started. As we were talking about before, the issue is not primarily a kosher issue. Chacham created a new area of kosher called Bishul Akum, but not because of a concern of what's going on with the ingredients and what's going on with the equipment. Putting that aside, that sometimes is an issue. So if I have someone in the kitchen whom I don't trust, that he or she has all the judgment necessary and all the sense of gravitas necessary to maintain kosher process, to maintain kosher ingredients and kosher equipment. So that's a problem. I think it's something I knew we touched on last time, and it's something maybe we could take up again. The questions of nemanos in the kitchen. That's not this. Bishul Akum begins once kosherus in the classical sense ends. Assuming that I know that my ingredients are all kosher, assuming that I know that the equipment is kosher, that's great, but I'm not all clear. Now I have to figure out, I have a non-Jew in my kitchen, I have a non-Jew in a restaurant kitchen, I have a non-Jew in an industrial setting, operating a food factory, a canning plant, what have you, and I have a mashgiach making sure, I have a system in place to make sure that all the food is kosher, all the equipment is kosher. That's great. But if a Nachri, the concept of Bishul Akum is that in principle, a Nachri takes an absolutely kosher steak. A Nachri takes a kosher piece of salmon and throws it on the grill, that the grill is kosher, the fish was kosher, but now that the Nachri cooked it, it becomes Bishul Akum. So that's this sort of Point number one is that the assumption everything is kosher going in, but the process of literally bishul akum, the non-Jew cooking the food, that could create a new issue. But the Gemara tells us that that a food is only going to be, not all foods are bishul akum sensitive. And the Gemara seems to come to the conclusion the way most Rishonim read the Gemara, that says the following is how we pass from the halacha, that there are two key conditions that a food needs to meet in order to be bishul akum sensitive. So let's talk about the conditions, and then we'll sort of break that out into the lamasa and the pantry. it said from raw to royal. The Gemara's first condition is it needs to be a food which is inedible raw. If the non-Jew baked an apple, some people may like their apples baked. It adds flavor, brings that, caramelizes, it brings that, it changes it. But the apple is entirely edible. We eat raw apples all the time. Our non-Jew heats water, makes coffee. You may enjoy your water hot rather than cold, but we certainly drink water, so to speak, raw. A non-Jew takes pasta, pre-made pasta, and melts cheese over the pasta. So the cheese got melted, but the cheese could have been eaten cold and raw as well. So and that's what the Gemara calls ne'echal chai. That condition number one that food needs to meet in order to be a problem is that the food is inedible raw. Now, in other words, that I needed the non-Jew's cooking to make this edible. And on the other end, the first condition is looking at what the food was like before the bishul akum. The second question is what it like after the bishul akum. Not only did the non-Jew take inedible food and make it edible, they made it really edible with distinction. The Gemara's second condition is that the food is ola al shulcha malacha, which literally means that it would be served on a royal table. Now I have to tell you that there was an opinion which is not which is very colorful, and there were some significant posts who held this way, but that's not the predominant view. There were those who understood that that's taken literally. Like, we actually care about what's served on the royal table. And there are kosher organizations who are reputed to have reached one kosher organization in particular, significant kosher organization. They reached out to the royal chef in Denmark. Denmark is one of the few countries in Europe that still has a royal family. They reached out to the royal chef in Denmark to find out what the menu looks like. The approach to the Chazon Ish even went so far as to assume that whatever the Queen of England eats at any time of day or night, that's like magical. Like, if the Queen of England eats sardines when no one else is looking, that's what she has for breakfast. So the Chazon Ish was of the opinion that, well, then sardines are a bishul akum problem, because, literally, olal shulchan lachem. We do not accept this lahalacha. The vast majority of poskim do not accept this halacha. We assume that olal shulchan lachem has nothing to do with actually the person of a king or queen, and it's an expression. It means that it's a more aristocratic food. It's a food that, translate even more, it's a food that would be served in a formal setting. That's when you look at the Oyu Tshuvas about bishul akum. Some of you know that Rabbanim go to Simchas professionally. So the poskim writing these... we're writing these tshuvas, will remark, well, I was at a wedding last week, I was at a wedding the week before, I was at a wedding before, and here's what the story of the shmorgon, so that the assumption is that olal shulchan lachem means it's food that will be served at a wedding, food that will be served at a formal setting. And the Rambam explains the rationale behind this. The non-Jew is making a significant contribution. On the one hand, it's not just, the apple could have been anyways, and I gave it a little extra pizzazz. I took something that was inedible. I took a potato. It was absolutely raw. I took chicken. I couldn't have eaten it at all. And step number one. Step number two, I really cooked it. He really cooked it. He really made a difference. And then, not only is it now edible, but it's a socially significant food. That's really the essence of the second condition of olal shulchan malachim. It's a socially significant food. Rambam says, if the whole concern of bishul akum is we want to create a roadblock so that socializing over food isn't just mindless and speed bump free. So the whole concern is food that has social significance. A bag of potato chips is not really something that you would mechabed a guest with. The sort of food that you would mechabed a guest, the sort of food you would serve at a formal function, that's the sort of thing that we're looking at. It should be noted before we get into practicalities, the post can point out that, you hear those two conditions, inedible raw, socially significant, the sort of thing you would serve formally. So the question is, inedible raw for whom? I would suspect that our great grandparents would have been horrified to see us eating baby carrots. Absolutely horrified. I mean, cooked baby carrots with honey and raisins, of course. Human beings eat tzimmis. But our great grandparents would have been horrified to see people eating raw carrots. Those are for the rabbits. Human beings eat cooked carrots. And my things have changed, right?
Or medium rare meat.
Yes.
Right? Something like that 100 years ago. They were too worried about getting
raw
sick.
Fish and certain cold.
Right. So the question is, well, who? Inedible raw for whom? And socially significant for whom? That also changes. It's actually fascinating to trace the evolution, the halachic evolution of the mushroom. The Gemara tells us that the Gemara goes through these two rules, in Maseches Avodah Zarah, and then it gives examples of foods that do fit the bill, don't fit the bill, foods that are bishlakim sensitive, not bishlakim sensitive. So the Gemara has a list of foods which are not bishlakim sensitive, and one of them is mushrooms. You read Poskim from 500 years ago on the page of Shulchan, 400 or 500 years ago, 1600s, in the page of Shulchan Aruch, and they say, oh, mushrooms are a bishlakim problem. And nowadays, mushrooms are once again not a bishlakim problem. Three stages, mutter, asr, mutter, and even the first and last stages aren't the same because they're for different reasons. And the Gemara, the Rishonim explained, the Gemara was assuming that mushrooms are not bishlakim sensitive because they were like a peasant food. You wouldn't serve the mushrooms where it would be insulting to serve mushrooms in a socially significant situation. 400 or 500 years ago, that had changed, which is still the case today. Right? You'll serve mushrooms. You can get places with mushrooms. Mushrooms have once again returned to being not bishlakim sensitive, but now for the other reason, because we eat raw mushrooms as well. You'll serve raw mushrooms in crudité. You'll slice mushrooms and throw them into a salad. So mushrooms were originally mutter, not sensitive to bishlakim, because they were ena ola shulchan lachem. They didn't meet criteria number two. That changed a couple of centuries ago. They were bishlakim sensitive, and now they're back to being bishlakim insusceptible for the other reason, because they're edible raw. And that's here's another example of cranberries. So cranberries are raw. If you've ever tried fresh cranberries, they're incredibly tart. So tart that unless you're really into that type of thing, you can't serve cranberries to guests unless you figure out a way to get a tremendous amount of sugar to adhere to the cranberries. Until not so long ago, the only way to do that was to boil them with sugar. So they were inedible raw, which is why it used to be that canned cranberry sauce needed, in order to give hashkacha to canned cranberry sauce, and here's just an angle on how bishlakim plays out in an industrial setting. It used to be until a decade or two ago, to give hashgacha on canned cranberry sauce, it wasn't enough to have a system and protocols in place that would ensure that the ingredients are kosher and the equipment are kosher, which meant setting up a system, setting up standards with the manufacturer, and then making spot checks. It used to be that cranberry sauce was bishlakim sensitive. No one would eat it raw, and ola shulchan lachem, you serve it at Thanksgiving, and you'll often serve. Some canned foods aren't really, they're not quality enough to serve in a formal setting. But canned cranberry sauce, mix it up and it goes. So until 20 years ago or so, to produce canned cranberry sauce with a hashgacha required mashgiach tamidi, because it meant every single run of the canning you needed to have a Jewish mashgiach there who would start up the equipment, so otherwise it would be bishlakim. The ingredients might be kosher, but if everyone doing the cooking is non-Jewish, you have bishlakim problems. So that's from an economic standpoint, that's much more labor intensive, and it was more expensive to give that hashgacha. With the advent of craisins, someone figured out a way to get sugar to adhere to cranberries without actually cooking them, which means that from that point, once craisins became common, cranberries flipped from being inedible raw to edible raw, and canned cranberry sauce is no longer bishlakim sensitive. So it's much cheaper to give hashgacha to canned cranberry sauce because you just need to have yotzei v'nichnas who make sure that the kashrus is in place, but bishlakim is no longer a consideration. So those are the two conditions the Gemara has. in order to be special akum sense, it needs to be, on the one hand, without the cooking, couldn't have eaten at all. And now, post-cooking, not only is it edible, but it's actually edible in a socially significant way.
Do you need both those conditions, or is it one?
Yes, you need both conditions in order to have an issur. So let's say cheese, right? So cheese can be a socially significant food, but melting cheese is still not bishul akum because the cheese is edible raw.
Let's say like pasta, like you wouldn't eat it, like you wouldn't eat it raw.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's, would people serve? Is that considered a socially acceptable food?
Socially significant, I think so. They serve a pasta. You go to
a
nice high-end restaurant.
Though, because you can't.
Yeah, so making pasta.
If you go to a high-end restaurant, they're making the pasta themselves. They're not going, it's homemade, it's real pasta. So there's a difference between, like, pasta that you, that's where...
Dry
pasta, where you go to the supermarket and you buy a box of pasta and you boil it. That's, like, the everyday way to do it. But if you're really going to be formal about it, they're not going to serve the box pasta to the queen. They're going to make real pasta from scratch.
So
it's going to be fresh.
I wonder.
And if you go to a nice restaurant, it should be from.
I wonder. Every caterer who does weddings,
they don't
makes their own pasta.
No, but I don't know.
I think that's
actually my question. Was there different types of weddings even?
Maybe
different caterers have different standards.
So does pasta fall under bishul? Like, because
yeah, so,
exactly.
So great.
So like, just because it's
so the way to unpack these theoretical conditions under contemporary conditions. It essentially translates into five categories of foods that are, that's what's called the five foods in the red zone. The five foods in the red zone are meats, fish, eggs, some vegetables, and grain-based foods like pasta. Well, let's put cookies and bread to the side for a moment. We'll get back to that. Steak tartare is there are people who eat raw meat, but the post can write based on the Gemara that the fact they have a tiny percentage of the population that eat something raw that doesn't make it edible raw. Fish is a discussion. Fish is some debate amongst the postkin. Until 20 years ago, who in the Western world was eating raw fish? Almost nobody. Sushi definitely has become more popular. So the question is, if a Nachri broils tuna for me, or Nachri broils salmon, they say, well, it was edible raw because it could have made sashimi or sushi. So I decided to grill it, but it's nachal chai. So my impression is that the jury is still out. For the following reason, my impression is most posts can assume that fish is still bishul akum sensitive, because I personally am partial to sushi, and I'll play with other people who are. I suspect though that and the question is that when you say in that culture, do people eat it raw? How granular are you being? You're looking at like a certain stratum of Bergen County, a certain stratum of New York City, and you're looking at like particular neighborhoods in San Francisco, or you're looking at the United States of America, red states, blue states, and coastal and everyone in between. Are you looking at the Jewish population, or are you looking at the general population? Of the 7-8 million people who live in New York City, yes, sushi is popular, but what does popular mean? As the majority of, if you asked, there are millions of people in New York City who eat pizza. There are millions of people in New York City who eat pasta. There are millions of people in New York City who eat chicken. Are there millions of people in New York City who eat sushi? Not sure. So I think the jury is still out. Now, we probably at some point will hit the tipping point. As sushi becomes increasingly popular, where we'll say, okay, like as with the cranberries, as with the mushrooms, say at some point, now it's popular. Raw fish has become popular enough that that's no longer a bishul akum problem. My impression is that we haven't reached that yet. So meat, fish, eggs.
Isn't just a question?
Sure.
Isn't there also, you can't just buy a piece of salmon and eat that well, there's sushi grade fish. It's not the same. I think
interesting.
It's not
okay.
The same fish. You have to buy treated fish that you can eat raw.
So that may play into this also. And then vegetables.
Can't those vegetables be eaten raw?
Right, so that's why I'm saying some vegetables, some not. So you think of whatever you would serve in crudité is not a raw, is not a bishlakim problem. So squash is not a bishlakim problem. Broccoli, cauliflower are not bishlakim problems. But potato, you know.
Squash? Artichoke?
Oh. I've never tried raw artichoke. It's hard to say. But known as raw potatoes in our culture, maybe there are cultures out there, us around the world, where raw potatoes are common. No one's eating raw potatoes. No one's eating raw eggplant, in part because it's incredibly bitter. So if a nachri is baking potatoes, grilling potatoes, so again, it may depend on how the potato is made. If it's a plain baked potato, that may not be ola shulchan lachem. But if it's a little more snazzy than that, grilled eggplant, so that already presents a problem. And then finally, grain-based foods. Grain-based foods tend to be inedible raw, and depending on the presentation, might be ola shulchan lachem. But here's an important footnote to that, which is that, and this is sometimes relevant, sometimes not, more relevant in a commercial context, is that the Mishnah presents two separate categories, bishlakim and pasakim. The bread sort of stands as a separate category. So something is definable as bread, whether it's the sort of thing that won't be mafresh challah on, which can include bread, which can include cookies, and things like that, the sort of thing that if you ate enough of, you would have to wash and bench. So those sorts of things are, breads are not bishul, they're pas. And here the key difference between bishul and pas is out of the home. The key difference between bishul and pas is that Ashkenazim accept a distinction by bread only between homemade and commercial. Is the reason why we're comfortable buying OU bread or Chafke bread is because Ashkenazi poskim accept that by pas, the pas is a lesser, less severe gzeira than bishul, and that Chazal only imposed it. And again, the whole rationale is not, even if the ingredients are kosher, we're worried about the social aspect. So by bread, which is less exciting than a food which is all shalchem lachem, so it's only if there's more of a direct connection. So you have someone who made home in a home setting, the neighbor made homemade bread, or a non-Jew in my kitchen made homemade bread. So at that point you have to worry about bishlakim. But to buy it from a baker, he's baking for me and for 1,000 other customers. So it's not the same degree of friendship, not the same degree of social connection. We do not have that kula by bishul. That's why there is bishlakim is a concern in a restaurant. Bishlakim is a concern in a factory. But pasakim is not a concern in a restaurant or a factory or a bakery for this reason. So that's what just to bear in mind. Let's say that
OU bread doesn't.
It's so hard to find OU bread.
OU bread will only have chal taken from it if the owner of the bakery is Jewish. Chal is separate from all this, but bread does require freshes chal if a Jew owns it at the time of the time. But if a non-Jew makes bread, and then I buy it afterwards, there's no. He didn't have to do a freshes chal. The chiyuv would have started when they were kneading the dough and baking, and it was not owned by a Jew, so that mitzvah didn't kick in, so it does not kick in later. If you have a Sfardim to eat the bread, you would need to have Jewish participation in the baking process, even if it's baked in a commercial setting or a bakery. For Ashkenazim, assume again what we call pas palter, if it's baker palter is another way to say baker, so baker's bread, Ashkenazim assume is not bishul akum sensitive. You need hashkacha to make sure the ingredients are kosher, to make sure they're not using lard, and so on and so forth. But assuming the ingredients are kosher, they're not. The Ashkenazi hashkacha on bread is not going to have a mashkiach there turn on the oven every single time. They just have a yotzev nifnas to make sure the ingredients are kosher. But again,
it's so hard to find kosher bread. It's like so interesting.
Well, that's because a year or two ago, the major purveyor of kosher bread of non-Jewish kosher bread sold out.
Even prior to that, though, outside of Maine,
right, like we were in Orlando last year.
I agree. In many other parts of the country, it was hard. I agree with
it's
that.
It's still hard.
And it's still
hard. You went to multiple supermarkets last year trying to find a kosher bread.
Just trying to encourage you to go low carb.
So why is it so hard to get a hashgacha if there's not so much required be mashgiach bread?
You need to make sure you're looking at there are other kosher issues in bread. Yeah. Number one, ingredients are sometimes an issue. In a factory that uses equipment for other foods as well, so then you have to keep track of what else the equipment is used for. Plus, in addition to toppings, fillings, and whatever flavorings might be a problem, there is a separate, it's not really our topic right now, but a separate gzeirah d'rabbanan. This could come up in the bakery or in the kitchen. Chazal made a separate, bread is less of a, has less social significance than a steak or tuna. So from a machali akum perspective, we're more making on bread than we are on cooked foods. But from a basar b'chalav perspective, Chazal saw bread because it's something that you eat with all sorts of meals. And again, until 40, 50 years ago, people were eating bread plenty with every meal. So bread is a dangerous vector in the kitchen because you could end up using your bread in multiple places. And that's why Chazal made limits, required that bread be parv.
Are you not allowed to make dairy bread?
Right, you can't make dairy bread unless it's very clearly dairy. Right. So that's another issue that could come into play. In other words, if they're using butter in the bread, unless it's clearly a milchic bread, that's going to be an issue. So getting back here, coming back to Bishul Akum, so again, our five categories, again, leaving aside the fact that if it's a bread or cookies, that sort of thing, it's pizza. So outside of a home, in a commercial setting, that's only pas. In a commercial setting, that's pas, and therefore, a commercial setting is going to be mutter. But if it's meat, or fish, or eggs, or vegetables that are only eaten cooked, or other grain-based foods, those are all bishalakam sensitive. And keep in mind, even pas, in my kitchen, whether it's in the non-Jew's kitchen or in my kitchen, that is a pas akum problem. So pas akum is on the list of gzeiros rabbanan. It's just that Ashkenazim assume that pas akum is limited to home-based situations. But if it's at home, for a non-Jew to make pizza in my kitchen is potentially a problem. Well, there are ways of solving it that we'll get to. If not tonight, then looks like next time or the time after, which is amazing. I'm glad to go on for as long as it takes. These are relevant issues. But again, so far we're talking about which foods are Bishul Akum sensitive. If it's Bishul Akum insensitive, so as long as everything's kosher, I don't have to be involved. If it's Bishul Akum sensitive, then we'll need to figure out a solution. But let's round out the discussion.
Did you do eggs?
Eggs, yes. Meat, fish, eggs. Some vegetables, those vegetables which are inedible raw, and grain-based products.
Is Bishul defined?
No, so that we'll get to. If you're looking at the outline, so I want to first talk about where we're in section 3. I just want to first talk which foods, and then we'll get to next time, Mirtz Hashem, different exceptional cases, and finally we'll talk about the cooking process, both in terms of what's considered cooking, microwaving, smoking, things of that sort, rewarming, as well as how can I be involved? How much do I have to be involved in order to mitigate a Bishul Akum problem? So I want to just, for now, for this evening, just wrap up the discussion of which foods with the following point. If you're in the outline, it's points D and E. Egg challah versus pizza with toppings. So the Gemara points out that up until this point, we've been talking about single ingredients, but not everything in the kitchen, by far, is a single ingredient food. So how do you deal with multi ingredient foods where some of the ingredients are Bishul Akum sensitive and some are not? So the post can differentiate between a food that's a blend versus a food that has a separate distinct parts. Egg challah versus pizza with eggplant topping. So the egg challah, as the post can point out, if you have an egg challah or even a challah that's, you know, that's brushed with egg. Now, the eggs themselves are, if I had an egg would be a bishalakim problem. And again, let's say now the bread itself is, bread could be pasakim, but let's say it's being made in a bakery. Let's say, and usually egg challahs are made by Jewish bakers. Let's say you have a non-Jewish baker making egg challah, a non-Jewish baker making an egg bread. So what do you do with the egg part? Is that a problem? Is that not a problem? So the post can point out, well, it's all blended together. So whenever you have something that's all blended together, or you have a kugel or something like that, whenever all the ingredients are blended together, so then you just figure out what's the primary ingredient, and that dominates. An example might be coffee, or hot chocolate, let's say, where I wouldn't, if I was looking just at the cocoa, so the cocoa is something you wouldn't eat raw, right? But the water or the milk, you would. So we say, since all the ingredients are blended together, we say, we'll follow the ikar. The ikar is the water, the ikar is the milk, the cocoa is adding flavoring, but that doesn't matter. So if the non-Jew makes hot chocolate, even if it's, you know, done properly, you know, boiled in a saucepan, and you have nice creamy hot chocolate, it's great. And it's true, the cocoa is enoneha, it would not be eaten raw, but I follow the ikar. Whenever it's a blend, or I have dough, which has egg in it, but I'm going to follow, whenever it's a blend, I follow the ikar.
What's considered the ikar in dough? The flour?
Yeah, the flour. And again,
it's also not in
the bowl. Right, true. but the point is that you're right. Just in a bakery setting, so the dough is not a problem because that's a bread. Bread is only a problem at home. Eggs could be a problem even in a bakery restaurant setting. But in that situation, everything's all blended together. I say, just follow the acre. Again, maybe hot chocolate is something easier to think about. On the other hand, let's say if I have the Rishonim, 700-800 years ago, we're talking about, they didn't call it calzones, the Ashkenazi Rishonim, who lived in countries where they spoke French or German, talk about pashtida, or pashtes, which sounds a lot like pasta. And the Sardi Rishonim, who are in Spanish-speaking countries, talking about panadas, which I think are empanadas. Do you have something like that? Or knish, or calzone, or whatever you want to call it. Or think about pizza with the eggplant topping. Right. So pizza, again, at home, the pizza dough is an issue. But in the pizzeria, that's passapalta, that's fine. The cheese could have been raw. The tomato sauce, even if they're making fresh tomatoes, but tomatoes are edible raw, so if a non-Jew stews tomatoes, that's not a problem. So plain pizza made in a pizzeria doesn't have any bishulakim problems or pasakim problems. But how about if they put toppings on? Well, it depends what the toppings are. But if they're slicing eggplant and putting eggplant on, well, that's a bishulakim problem. And it's not blended. They're separate chunks. So everything lives its own life. So here I have a piece of eggplant. It happens to be sitting on top of a pizza. That's great. But here's a piece of eggplant that's slowly roasting. And as it roasts, it goes from being a kosher raw eggplant to being a non-kosher grilled eggplant. Non-kosher because it's bishalakam. And then the post can point out not only is an eggplant non-kosher, now you can have little bits of eggplant all over the pizza. So even peeling it off may be a problem as well. And the flavor that it gives to the pizza, the rest of the pizza may be a problem as well. So again, so far we spoke about the problem. I like to be a positive person, but at the same time I also want to be sensitive to your time. So far we spoke about the problem, and next time we'll talk about solutions. Well, the truth is we already spoke about some solutions, because we already narrowed what we've done. Let's think about where we've been. We explored the rationale for Bishalakam, and the concern of Chasnas, meaning the concern to be sensitive between friendly with all Tzelem Elokim, but our friends are those whom we have a close social connection, are those whom we share values. And Chazal were very intent on making sure that we would maintain that sensitivity. And one of the ways to maintain the sensitivity is through limitations on whose food we eat and how. And we saw that the entire concern of Bishalakim only begins if the food fits the two categories. Number one, fits both conditions. It's only going to be even a potential for a problem, Yishalakim, if the food was inedible raw, and once it's cooked, it's not only edible, but it is olal shulchan malachim. It's a socially significant food, the sort of thing that could be served at a significant function. And we closed by talking about, beginning to think about multi-ingredient foods. So next time we're going to talk about a couple of, just looking forward, let's say, if my food is not bishlakim sensitive, no problem. But let's say, if a non-Jew is making candies with sugar, with honey, and maybe some flavorings, but the primary ingredient is sugar, primary ingredient is honey, which again, as we know, from sticking our fingers in, you can definitely eat it raw. So it's not a problem at all. Right? Or if the primary ingredient is tomatoes, the primary ingredient is milk, not a problem. But let's say it's not. Let's say it's not. If it's a chicken soup, you got yourself a problem. And there may be some carrots in there, it's great, but clearly the primary ingredient is not the carrot and not the water, the primary ingredient is the chicken. So that sort of thing, as I said before, the five sorts of foods that tend to track bishlakim problems: meat, fish, eggs, some vegetables, and most grain-based products. So we'll talk about next time. We'll open with the exceptional cases. Cooking on Shabbos. Yes, we'll talk about cooking on Shabbos, bishlakim on Shabbos, and the aftermath of a bishlakim catastrophe in the kitchen. Those things do happen. It's important to ask. And as we will discover next time, the kitchen is often much easier to solve in the aftermath of a bishlakim slip-up than you might think. So that's always, as I said, we'll close with how we began. It's always important to ask questions. Sometimes the answer is more chumra than you expected. Sometimes we would otherwise, make assumptions that are too kal. Often we would end up making assumptions that are too inappropriately chumra. And then our final major issue will be to talk about cooking processes and which sort of cooking processes can induce bishlakim. Which not. Thank you so much for coming out. I'm glad to stick around for questions if you'd like.
I have a question.
Sure.
Everyone's really good. But so eggs.